Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and this is episode number 781. By my count, I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, as usual, and delighted to be back with a wonderful panel. We have a real exciting topic today, talking about Presbyterian history, one of my favorite things to speak about. And we have some new guests as well as some familiar faces. Let me introduce to you first a co-host of sorts, my Presbytery brother. We have Dr. Alan Strange, who's professor of church history as well as registrar and theological librarian down at Mid-America Reformed Seminary in Dyer, Indiana. Welcome back, Alan. It's so good to see you today. How are you doing?
Thanks. Good to be here.
Yes, I'll see you in person, Lord willing, tomorrow. We got a little bit of a board meeting at the seminary and some important matters to take up, exciting things. So, Lord willing, we can converse and follow up on all the exciting things we'll be talking about today. I want to introduce to you now our first guest. We have Dr. Kenneth J. Stewart, who's Professor Emeritus of Theological Studies at Covenant College. Welcome, Ken. It's good to see you, too. How are you?
Good to be here.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for joining us. We're looking forward to speaking with you and with your co-author on a book that we're going to mention in a minute, Dr. Donald Fortson III, Professor of Church History and Pastor and Pastoral Theology at the Charlotte campus at Reformed Theological Seminary. Also a former professor of some of my close friends, one of which is Carlton Wynn. Welcome, Dr. Fortson. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Good to see you. It's that time of year we were talking toward the end of the semester. All the papers are rolling in. Ken, I imagine that you are not missing that time of year. Is that correct?
That's true, but I still teach a course this semester, and I have that much grading to do.
One course. We'll take it. That sounds just about right. You keep your toes in it and still have an impact on the students, but you're not overwhelmed with, who knows, 50, 100, 150 assignments, whatever they may be. It's exciting. Today, we're speaking about a really exciting book, one I'm sure that many of our viewers and listeners have a copy of already, Reformed and Evangelical Across Four Centuries, The Presbyterian Story in America. It's co-authored by four authors. We have two of them with us today, but in addition to Dr. Stewart and Fortson, we also have Nathan Feldmeth and Garth Rozelle. It's published by Erdmans, and has a foreword by none other than George Marsden. Many of you will know him as well. Very fascinating book, and we have a number of excellent chapters on a whole host of issues regarding Presbyterian history in America, all moving towards a common thread or along a common thread, and speaking about some topics from different perspective than, and an important perspective. Than some of you may be familiar with, or at least haven't read recent volumes covering these topics. I'd like to start with you, perhaps, Dr. Stewart, if you might explain to us, or at least open up to us and the listeners, a bit of the idea for this book. And if you wouldn't mind so much recounting the idea for it and how the idea came about and eventually made its way into print.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to address that.
Sure.
There's a very personal side to this book, and it is that my colleague Don Fortson visited Covenant College 8 or 10 years ago for the purpose of introducing his son to Covenant College. Don Fortson is himself an alumnus of Covenant College, and we were introduced and had lunch together. And I'm really a church historian, though I have had to teach some theology also. So we got to talking over a meal about how sad it was that modern books on Presbyterian history reflected the particular denominational focus of the authors, whoever those might be, and that there was no longer a text or texts which address the family history, and so that this is not an abstract idea, let me elaborate. 50 or 60 years ago, there were still books being written, usually by mainline authors, that helped all Presbyterians and all expressions of the movement to get a sense of common history. I'm referring to books like Leonard Trinchroot and Lefferts Letcher.
Mm-hmm.
I read some of these books at Westminster Seminary in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
But since that time, that type of text that tells the story of the whole family has become very, very hard to locate. What we have are many histories, not written from a narrow agenda, but reflecting largely the denominations for which the histories are written. There are books like this about the ARP. There are books like this about the EPC. There are books like this about the PCA. And mm-hmm. you both know there are books of this type written for an OPC constituency.
Oh, yeah.
But if you look into any of these modern books from outside the tradition it was written to serve, you find an incompleteness. So the idea was, let's address the fact that books addressing the common heritage have ceased to be written, and let's acknowledge the fact that modern books which have been written serve denominational interests primarily, and let's produce something that transcends these limitations. And it began in a lunchtime conversation. We drew up a sketch of what the book would look like, and we began to recruit. And this was a tougher challenge than it first appeared it would be. But eventually we secured not only two additional historians, but importantly, historians from other branches of the Presbyterian family. I'm PCA, Don Fortson is EPC.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we needed to do was to find two others, and we did. And it turned out that this representation was absolutely critical in securing a publisher. Publishers are concerned about marketing, and in order for a book of this type to secure a wide readership, it would need to transcend denominational interests. And so after several failed attempts with other publishers, we eventually secured the backing of Erdmann's. And from that point on, it was about a 5-year process to write and edit this book for publication.
Wonderful. Yeah, and explain some of the logic. There's a rationale, not only to having people from different Presbyterian communions, but also the four that are represented by the authors. Explain a bit of that mix and how that's useful and helpful for telling this particular history.
Don, would you like to address that question?
Sure. Ken and I had, as we talked about the project, really thought that it would be prudent if we could have a multi-authored work that would be representative of the larger Presbyterian family of churches, especially. We kind of had two factors going on. If you look at the PCUSA, PCA, EPC, ECO, you've got the four largest Presbyterian bodies, but the other side of it was that we definitely wanted as much as possible to include some of the narrative from the smaller Presbyterian bodies too. And that was one of the greater challenges for us to try to do all the above. But getting the four authors representing the four different traditions, that was just, I think, one of our best decisions to do. It made it, I think it made the book more balanced, I think, because we brought some different perspectives to the table. We made sure everyone had a voice at the table that was important. And actually, as one of the authors, I'd say it's one of the richest writing experiences I've ever had. It was an incredible amount of work, as Ken and I edited the whole thing.
Yeah.
But it was just great to engage and have Zoom conferences with the different authors and discuss and debate and It was just very engaging process to do it that way.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Alan, I noticed we ended up on an airplane together. In hindsight, it makes total sense because we were both heading to PCA General Assembly from Chicago, so there's only so many flights to Birmingham in any given day. But you're reading this book on the airplane back in June. How did you come about it? And do you have a particular interest in this, not only personally as an historian, a Presbyterian historian at that, but also as someone who teaches history in the seminary classroom?
Yes, I mean, I appreciate very much what Ken was saying and what Don has been saying as well, in complimentary fashion. I think this fills a lacuna that has existed in more recent decades, as Ken was observing. You know, that older tradition of whether it's Lesher or Smalley or whoever addressing more broadly these issues. We have had the more particular denominational perspectives. So I appreciated it for that reason, particularly. And there's a lot I'm sure you're familiar with, Camden, and I'm sure my colleagues here are perhaps have seen some critical reviews. I'm thinking of Daryl Hart's in Ordained Servant. It's Daryl's a good friend of mine, and it's vintage Daryl, if I can, say that. and so I you know, he's raising the whole question of Reformed and Evangelical and the relationship. And there has been a lot of talk about that. But I do think that this meets a certain need and fills a certain place. It's interesting on the back, the first comment is by Tim Keller, who said he's been waiting for a book of this sort. And just understanding the whole project that Tim has been involved in for some decades now, and many associated particularly with that, I can see why that would be the case. It is the case that I could argue that Machen should perhaps receive a little bit more attention, and that movement, even having an influence disproportionate to its size, perhaps. But you could also argue that there's a good bit written on that outside of this.
Yeah. So even in Letcher, especially. Yeah.
What's that?
Even in Lefferts Letcher's volume, The Broadening Church. I mean, useful.
So you know, these things are always. It's always interesting. I mean, I've certainly done reviews of books in which part of my criticism is what they didn't talk about. But that's, you know, there's that legitimacy is, it only goes so far, because I mean, the authors of a book do get a presumptive definition of their parameters and their scope and what they're trying to do. And I think these men in this book do definitely a service to the Presbyterian Church more broadly, of addressing some things down even to our present that do need to be addressed, that are helpfully addressed.
Sure.
Certainly I could say, you can always say things that are, you didn't address this, or this would have been better, you should have tied this together. There's so much to do in history, right?
Well, but certainly.
I appreciate the book very much.
I appreciated it greatly myself, Ken and Don. I'm thankful you're able to talk about it here as well. And, you know, obviously whenever you're editing, especially history, you have to select what to include. And I appreciated that though you have four different authors from four different traditions, I mean, all Presbyterian, but four different specific denominations, I did get an overwhelming sense that the book was moving in a direction and telling a unified story. That's at least from my perspective where it was headed. And that really flows forth. I think the title is apt. It's a solid title and a descriptive one, Reformed and Evangelical Across Four Centuries. That seems to me a mild, not an overt, but it's a mild thesis statement. And I wanted to set the stage for you, at least ask you the question of what is unique about this book. Right away in the introduction, Ken, I believe you wrote that. Forgive me if others pitched in on that specific chapter, but you spoke about distinctive features of this volume, four of them, namely, oh, I should say, never mind, this is coming from Marsden's foreword. Nevertheless, it's disclosing what your intent was in terms of presenting a common theme through all these different chapters of Presbyterian history. Would you mind unpacking that a bit, or at least commenting on your your design here?
No doubt, Don will want to.
Sure, both of you. Yeah.
But picking up initially on what Alan has said, let me remind you both that Don and I are both Westminster alumni.
Oh, yes.
And so we know the narrative as we acquired it at Westminster. And Machen, for example, is a very large part of that narrative. The humbling thing of a project which involved collaborating with two other evangelical historians is that they were aware of Machen, but he was not nearly as central to the narrative of how an evangelical Presbyterianism sustained itself for the following half century, as Don and I would have presumed it was. And this is simply an illustration of the give and take. The four authors had in common an allegiance to a conservative evangelicalism, a broadly reformed position. All four of us are members of Evangelical Theological Society, but the sustaining of evangelical Presbyterianism has not required exactly the same ingredients for each of the four branches. Another illustration of this same issue is you may have been surprised to see the treatment given to Charles Finney. Mm. Now, for example, again, if you took church history at Westminster, the judgment had already been made, you know, about where Finney fit in this picture. He didn't belong in it at all. you could have said the same about Albert Barnes.
Yeah.
But in the larger picture of things, Albert Barnes and Charles Finney are part of the story, and they need to be addressed. And yes, their legacy was very mixed, but Westminster people left to themselves would tend to marginalize and exclude these people from the story. So again, this is an illustration of the give and take. Had we not had shared theological commitments from the outset, this could have got unwieldy. But given our shared theological commitments, we could allow a breadth to the narrative that under other circumstances wouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But now over to your questions, Camden.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the most critical things about this book, in addition to the fact that it's written by authors across four denominations, is that the British roots are stressed. I don't know what has been your experience, but the theological education I received in the 1970s at Westminster, the British connection was pretty well downplayed. And the idea is that the Reformed tradition has come down to us almost straight from Geneva, with only a kind of an interlude in Scotland. We all recognize that the Westminster documents are a product of the Puritan age. There's no attempt to obscure that. But the difficulty is that if you stress the Geneva angle, you actually lapse into something that is unhistorical, because the Presbyterian and Reformed tradition were not mediated to us directly from Geneva. The liturgy, the hymnody, the polity, as well as the theology, have all been mediated to us through the UK. But this has come to be a common failing, both of mainline histories, you know, Bradley Longfield and the type of material he produces. But it is true also of the material produced by Hart and Neither. The Geneva connection gets stressed, but the historical particulars of how the tradition was mediated to us from Britain has been left to drop out of sight. And this leaves us at a loss to explain and to understand the historical data about migration, about the transmission of liturgy, polity, theology, hymnody. Reinserting that back into the story was a very deliberate and a very critical part of this project.
Yeah, I presume some of that may be different now at Westminster with our colleague, our friend Chad Van Dixhorn, and his expertise on the standards, maybe reemphasizing more of that British context in the roots. But I for one, when I opened this book and realized how many chapters were devoted to that, I thought, wow, that was the first thing that really stuck out to me of how much time and how much space was devoted to that subject. And I appreciated it greatly. It's useful. Don, has that been your experience as well? You have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would just say some of the feedback I've gotten on the book from some folks, it's been their favorite part of the book, those early chapters, because typically American Presbyterians know little about that. Now, of course, specialists know it, but we're writing for the church, and we just felt like that part of the story is just so fundamental to understanding American Presbyterians. And where it really struck home to me, I've had a great interest in doing a lot of work in the colonial era. And so many of the discussions in the colonial era were revolved around folks from the different parts of Britain coming with some different ideas and perspectives. And, you know, this new experiment in America, we're going to have a grassroots Presbyterianism from the bottom up. You got Scots, you got, you know, the English, you got some of the Dutch Reform, the Huguenots. And they had to grapple with their Reformed, you know, heritage. And often the Scottish church just lived large always. Do we want to be like Scotland? You know, and all these different issues. And repeatedly, the colonial Presbyterian said, no, not exactly, because we're in a different environment, a new day. But they appreciated the heritage and knew they were living in light of that. So anyway, that's kind of what has sparked my interest in, I think, in the British context, is that this was just a huge issue for the colonial era, for them to think through their background and what they all brought to the table as they tried to create this thing called American Presbyterianism.
Yeah, that's tremendously helpful. Alan, this might be a little bit inside baseball, but I'm wondering if your colleagues ever would let you get away with neglecting the British roots of our family tree, because at Mid-America, there's such an interaction with not only the continental tradition, but the Presbyterian. So when you speak of Reformed people at Mid-America, that means something different than what most Presbyterians use the word Reformed. We're talking often about the continental side of things. And I'm sure your colleagues are very quick to remind you that we didn't spawn directly from Geneva.
That's right. Yeah, I think, but just to help, as this book is meant to, the man or woman in the pew, to remember that the American Presbyterian Church didn't, you know, spring fully formed from the head of Zeus like Athena.
Right.
I think that's really significant. And I think that was a strong, I was really glad to see that in the beginning. And of course, obviously, we talked quite a bit about, you know, the transition from, you know, Knox in the most perfect school coming, and all that happens in Scotland, all that happens in England, that whole situation, quite significant. And as Don is saying, it makes it, the interest is heightened in where do things differ then? What were self-conscious choices made about, no, we don't want to do this way. And even to help people understand, because it seems, it just, if you don't give the background, for example, the discussions in 1729, especially in the Adopting Act, and why, and the significance of moving towards disestablishment. I mean, this is monumental. This is very, very significant. And so, yeah, it's good to have all that really in view like that. Yeah. And I appreciate this because it's done, as Ken was pointing out. I mean, all of the authors are coming from an evangelical faith commitment.
Right.
But this isn't mere filial pietism or hagiography.
Mm-hmm.
This is real history. And this is something that I tell the guys, I say, now, Drs. Veneman, Dr. Beach, in systematics, they both have a great deal of work in historical theology, and you're going to get a lot of historical theology there. And that's good, because that frees me up to do actual real church history, which isn't the same as just historical theology.
Right. Yeah.
I agree.
Amen. Yeah, we got to get those disciplines right.
This is church history.
Yeah. Yeah. Picking up on that, some of those thoughts, Alan, and as I pose a question to our guests, that's another key feature of this, not only the British background here to this American Presbyterian history, but also, as what Marsden says, is the symbiotic relationship that has frequently existed between American Presbyterianism and American evangelicalism. Now, those two are not identical. I mean, we have a Venn diagram of sorts, but I'd love for either of you or both of you to perhaps comment on this, maybe distinguishing, but comparing and contrasting American Presbyterianism and American evangelicalism, because at least from my perspective, apart from those British backgrounds, this was the main story that carries through all, if not, well, at least most of all the chapters here in this book.
Give a caveat as we begin. I do think the scholars, of which Ken would be one, that have pressed the argument for the emergence of evangelicalism really being rooted in the Protestant Reformation and not just, you know, an 18th century development, i.e. the Bevington thesis. Now, we utilize the Bevington thesis just as a helpful grid, you know, in the book, and even tried to integrate it into those early chapters to show that we must acknowledge that some of what is characteristic of the evangelical movement, as it's broadly understood, certainly has its roots, you know, in the Reformation era, particularly the commitment to the authority of Scripture is just foundational. If there's one thing that evangelicals may disagree on, what the Bible means and how we interpret it, but we don't disagree on the fact that it is the infallible Word of God.
Amen. Yeah.
And so, you know, and that's Reformation. And of course, as we all know, that term evangelical was used of Lutheranism, you know, from the very beginning. So anyway, with that caveat, I think as you come into the colonial era, if we do at least acknowledge that, I think we can say evangelicalism catapulted into a very prominent presence in both Britain and America as a result of the Great Awakening, just in terms of the sheer numbers of people that had conversion experiences or renewal experiences, the public preaching, you know, of the scriptures, the real commitment to, you know, spiritual growth and renewal in the churches. You know, the colonial folks were just as aware of spiritual dryness in the churches as they were in the traditional Anglican context that the Wesleys dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Presbyterians obviously have had somewhat mixed reviews on revivalism, Although I tend to associate that more with the second awakening than the first awakening. But the way that Presbyterians really got on board with the Great Awakening, they were many of them were close friends of both Whitfield and Edwards here in America. And obviously there were parts of the colonial church that took some issue with some things in Whitfield's theology. Edwards was, though, very close to the colonial men, particularly the Presbytery of New York and then the later Synod of New York, very close association with them. They reflected that, appreciated what they were about. And I'd argue a lot of the colonial leaders, like John Dickinson, for example, Gilbert Tennant, and others were very very connected to the work that Whitfield was doing. They resonated with it. They supported it. And Dickinson, for example, a lot of folks forget this, was in many ways shared with Edwards this attempt to bring a bit of balance to some of the excesses, even of the Great Awakening. There were times where things got out of hand. James Davenport and others did some pretty crazy stuff. But Dickinson was trying to see the good in the midst of the downside, just like Edward did on his, you know, his work on how you recognize a genuine conversion experience and the general work of God through his lectures there. Presbyterians, if I could wrap up my comments here, Presbyterians on the whole were supportive of the awakening, and the evidence for that is very clearly the fact that by the time of the reunion of the old school, the old side and the new side in 1758, three quarters of the church came from more of the new side. And we could talk more about the influence on the founding of Princeton and that kind of thing, but you can't get away from the historical reality that the Great Awakening shaped Presbyterianism just like it shaped the larger evangelical movement in America in the 1740s, especially.
Sure. That's pretty convincing, at least on that point. I imagine some old siders might say not all Presbyterianism is Presbyterianism. Just to perhaps misuse some of Paul's comments in Romans. But,
let me just jump in on this question, too. I'd like to refer specifically to the fifth chapter of the book, which deals with theology and mission and so on up to the end of the Puritan age. This is where the Bebington Quadrilateral is introduced in the book. And what I try to show is two things. Number one, the characteristics that we would associate with George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards are all present in the British churches after 1662. There's itinerant evangelism, very often by Puritan preachers who were put out of their pulpits in 1662. There is also missionary activity. There are several mission activities founded in this period. And eventually, Jonathan Edwards in Massachusetts will be sponsored by a Scottish mission society that focuses both on immigrants and on indigenous people. This is a period of serious biblical scholarship. Matthew Henry and Matthew Poole are both writing serious Bible commentaries. So the Bebington characteristics are clearly visible before 1730. And there is also, both in England and colonial America, there are outbreaks of spiritual awakening on both sides of the Atlantic well in advance of 1730. By the end of chapter 5, I have argued this, not that all Presbyterians were evangelical or could be characterized as evangelical, But evangelical characteristics were widespread enough among Presbyterians that it was one of at least four identifiable emphases, each of which crossed the ocean. And so there was theological diversity, and there was also difference of piety among Presbyterians observable from that point on. So the argument is not that all Presbyterians have always been evangelical, but that evangelical emphases have always been present in the Presbyterian and Reformed tradition.
That's helpful. You know, another thing that you pull out of that, you mentioned the missionary impulse, and that's something that gets teased out in multiple places throughout the book. I'm wondering if you can speak about that and Presbyterians' emphasis on missions. I mean, in Alan and in my own small tradition of the OPC, we kind of were born out of a mission conflict regarding the Independent Board of Presbyterian Foreign Missions, and that's always been, in many ways, at the heart of our identity, you know, and all the ecclesiological aspects that tie into that. But how have Presbyterians more broadly considered been involved in missions, and what are some of the hot points here that have been maybe you know, lightning rods for conflict throughout the ages, and why so?
Yeah, it's interesting how, you know, from the very beginning, it does appear that Presbyterians in America had significant interest in trying to reach the Native Americans and also ministry to slaves. It's certainly true that some took more intentional interest in this than others and were committed to that. But it was always present, I think, in their sense. And I think they inherited this from their New England brethren, the Congregationalists. Even as the Puritans came over to America, they did have a sense of responsibility to preach the gospel to the Native Americans. And Presbyterians, I think, were really committed to that.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the 19th century, when you got the beginning of the Second Great Awakening, and then you move in those early decades, the founding of the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, and of course, 19th century America is known as the great period of missionary expansion. And and much of that did grow out of some of the influence, you know, of the Second Awakening and the desire to see people come to know Jesus Christ. And so Presbyterians did participate in that that particular board, but there it also pressed the issue for having distinctive Presbyterian missions. And, of course, that was one of the debated issues between the old school and the new school. You know, God bless the Princeton men. They seem to want to argue, can't we do both?
Yeah.
but
and,
they're...
And just to, and Don, if I may just jump in to remind everyone, till you mentioned the Second Great Awakening, well, that's sort of a trajectory and a direction, particularly Finney, you know, says he's purposed and set against the hated doctrine of the inability of man. But you had before that Timothy Dwight, Asa Hell Nettleton. You had these people who were pretty sound. And
yes.
I very much resonate. I also have to say about chapter five, I mean, I've been making this argument in my own way for some time as somebody who very much appreciates New Side. So I have some good debates with some of my brethren in the OP about this. And I agree entirely, Ken, and I think it needs to be heard what you said, that this proper understanding of evangelicalism extends back definitely to the Reformation. I mean, we can talk about trappings and how it developed, and that's everything, right? We're historians. We contextualize everything. But I think you're quite right. And I think that's one of the strengths of the book. I intend to use this with my students. We have Presbyterian history next semester.
Don, do you want to cap anything off on that point?
Well, I would just say how Presbyterians were completely committed to world mission.
Oh yeah,
they really in the 19th century and throughout the book, we try to highlight the different places where they were a part of these collaborative interdenominational missions,
mm-hmm.
but also had distinctive Presbyterian missions. They were interested in reaching the Mexican population that was in the Southwest. They were mm-hmm. interested in the Native Americans. They were interested in the slave population, the free blacks after the war. And it's just consistent. Home missions and world missions were a high priority in the church mm-hmm. always. And so, and I would say, I mean, one thing that's always tied evangelicalism together, in addition to its commitment to scripture, is its commitment to the Great Commission.
Yeah.
I mean, it just has. It's in our DNA. And of course, the term evangelical means the gospel.
Mm.
And the proclamation of the gospel is our one of our primary calls as the Church of Jesus Christ to do that. And Presbyterians were all in supporting it. And I'd say one of the places that this was accentuated in the Providence of God was at Old Princeton Seminary.
Mm.
From the get-go, Archibald Alexander, Hodge, Miller, and that Society for the Inquiry of Foreign Missions, they just were delighted to see so many of their graduates go into world missions. It gave them great joy to see that. And so Presbyterians were part of that great wave of the going to the four corners of the earth in the 19th century.
Amen. Amen. We can only pray that that would continue, that we continue sending out more and more missionaries because the work still persists and is necessary. Christ has not returned, and the Great Commission still stands. We need to be out there. You know, missions is one of those evangelical features of evangelicalism, a missionary impulse. Another is a theological seriousness. And of course, there's a whole host of issues here regarding confessional subscription and those sorts of things throughout Presbyterian history. Those are topics that are touched on many times throughout the book. I'm happy to, if you'd like to talk about that at all, but by all means, take it away. But I wanted to ask you both a little bit more specifically about the idea of cultural transformation, this evangelical notion of seeking to impact the culture. And there's been a wide range of approaches to how this is done, obviously, and it's highly debated amongst many people. But you know, how has this played its way out through Presbyterian history as well? And what are some of the key features or at least key moments where we see this particular impulse evidenced?
Arguably, especially if we think of 19th century, the group that was most committed to this were the New School Presbyterians.
Mm-hmm.
No question about this. And Exhibit A, of course, was their just real commitment to abolition. They were, you know, leaders in the Sabbatarian movement. They were concerned about the spread of alcoholism in the United States. They were interested in collaborating with missions, in ministries to the poor. And one of the ways that we, at one point, tried to talk about this in the book, beyond kind of the New School era, where it's very obvious about their real commitment to that, was medical missions. And I thought that was a good thing that we tried to bring to attention. And I know many Presbyterian missions have been medical missionaries over mm-hmm. the years. And just this real sense that word and deed must go hand in hand together. And so I think that's a great illustration of that in terms of the larger Presbyterian story, that wherever missionaries have gone from any branch of the church, they have, particularly in areas where they've do not have adequate health care, that always is a priority. Not only typically that education is a priority for Presbyterians on the mission field, but alongside that is caring for the physical needs of the people.
Mm-hmm. There's an interesting thread there. I hope to have a whole episode about that topic through the lens of Meredith Klein down the road. We're working through with the OPC committee for the historian working through the Meredith Klein archives now. And just as a side note, it's quite interesting. Meredith Klein was a very noted opponent to some of those things within the missionary activities of the OPC, but not because he didn't think that those are, you know, godly activities and good things to do in terms of loving our brother, but he had a specific opposition to the church as church doing the missionary activities versus maybe, you know, an NGO of some sort supporting, you know, those activities. So it gets into an interesting ecclesiastical and ecclesiological question, a doctrinal question, which here we see kind of the confluence of this missionary impulse and the theological precision of Presbyterians maybe, you know, coming into contact. So that's perhaps a conversation for another day, but an interesting one at that. But Ken, do you have any thoughts on the cultural transformation or perhaps a political activism and all sorts of stuff?
I'd like to direct your attention to the 14th chapter. Mm. I didn't write this chapter, but I learned a lot by editing it. this chapter, which is called Immigration, Urbanization, and Industrialization, is full of surprises. Who knew that in the first 20 or 30 years of the 20th century that Presbyterians were as concerned as they were for the urban poor? Mm. There's a very interesting narrative here of how a man who was a graduate of Moody Bible Institute was made the head of the social service division of the PCUSA. And there's very little doubt that he had been influenced by Walter Rauschenbusch. But his great arch foe in the General Assembly, arguing against this type of social ministry, was none other than Charles Erdman, whom we have been led to believe was a kind of a wet noodle. You know, that he was so determined to get along with people, right, that he would flex. But you read this chapter and your head spins, because it's Charles Erdman, whom we have been led to vilify, who is the person who stands up to what to him represents a serious theological danger. Charles Erdman wins, and the Moody Bible Institute graduate who has been in charge of the social ministry in Chicago and other places like this, he resigns because there is such opposition. So here's a serious attempt to do social ministry. Here is an opposition to social ministry coming from an unexpected quarter. And yet this does not seem to have been a defining issue in the 1920s. It was a hotly debated issue, but people had convictions about the rightness or the wrongness of social ministry, irrespective of their other theological commitments. Mm. So that treatment is very interesting. In the same chapter, there's very thought-provoking material about how California Presbyterians went to the defense of Asian immigrants who were being shut out of public schools. It seemed to the Presbyterians of California in the early decades of the 20th century that their Christian responsibility was to defend the civil rights of these immigrants and to see that their children had a proper education. In this chapter, there is almost a serendipitous element. We're learning things about the Presbyterian past that take us off guard and which do not lead to predictable outcomes. And I would say that chapter 14 is one of the more stimulating chapters in the book as a whole, simply because it upends our stereotypes.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And it is a thoughtful chapter at that. Very interesting. There's all sorts of other topics that are also stimulating, provocative maybe even, but certainly different topics that I haven't read treatments of from a Presbyterian perspective. Obviously, there's a wonderful chapter 16 on fundamentalism and modernism. I got to say, I scoured the footnotes on this one and added quite a bit to my Zotero, which is my citation management system. So I have a new reading list queued up for me to pick up on some of the themes here and the different approaches. I'm curious what your experience was, if you don't mind divulging a little bit of behind the scenes, behind the curtain. What was it like to edit a chapter on modernism and fundamentalism with, you know, the wider, broader representation of Presbyterian bodies here? Any thoughts on this? Because certainly a chapter like that written in one of our denominational histories, like Fighting the Good Fight, for example, by Hart and Meether, is going to have a certain cast to it. And I think a useful one. It's beneficial to our church for that reason. But this topic in particular, I wondered if you could explain some of the different tone or the different presentation in this particular book that might distinguish it from other volumes.
Don, you may have insight, so I will be very brief. I think that the undertow in this chapter is that though higher criticism of the Bible was distressing and threatening, the majority of evangelical Presbyterians found a way to persevere in spite of this over decades. There was no denial that the higher criticism of the Bible was being taught. Mm. And there was no questioning that it was met with apprehension. But it was not universally treated as the defining issue that would require ecclesiastical separation. And so the persistence of an evangelical Presbyterianism outside the self-consciously conservative denominations indicates that there were other strategies for dealing with the negative effects of higher criticism than ecclesiastical separation. Eventually, ecclesiastical separation eventuated, but it was not per se the persistent activity of higher criticism that provoked this. You could say it was the cumulative effects of it, but not the immediate effects. So the thing to be explained is, how did so many conservative Presbyterians persevere in settings in which theological education was unreliable? And that leads into a subject that the book doesn't deal with, but there were developing networks from the 1920s onward among conservative Presbyterians, sometimes in conjunction with other evangelicals, which did an end run around the destructive effects of higher criticism. Mm. But enough on that for now. Don, what would you add? Mm.
Well, I guess in the early 20th century, Ken has hit the main points there. I think the big picture is, if you look at the whole scheme of the Presbyterian story in the 20th century, is evangelical Presbyterians have drawn the proverbial red line at different points, is the long and short of it. It's right. The reason so many of the different denominational groups hold together. I could just share a personal experience with that. My heritage is Southern Presbyterian. I'm about five generations of Southern Presbyterians. My grandfather, for whom I'm named, was one of the founding board of directors of the Southern Presbyterian Journal. My father was the mainline pastor, as I was, for a number of years. And so I knew from their experience, from mine, just kind of the challenges of living in that context. And there are just so many evangelicals that were really committed to stay in the course, staying in the main line as long as we felt like our consciences would allow, to be a testimony for the good. And it was always the sense that, you know, if I leave the pulpit in this local congregation, it's likely a liberal may come in to this situation. And what responsibility do I have to take a stand, to be a witness in my presbytery, in my denomination? And, you know, looking back at it now from the vantage point of the 21st century, in hindsight, it's always 20/20. Mm. Look and say, well, you can have a lot of debates about who lingered too long, mm. who jumped ship too quick. And, you know, I think it really boils down to calling that people have, you know, on these issues, is to what the Lord would have them to do within yeah. that. For those that have reformed convictions, they're evangelical in their core commitments.
Right.
Okay, and then they've got this ecclesiastical affiliation, and how am I going to negotiate this? And I think part of the ethos of evangelicalism, which is, and again, back to the First Great Awakening, you could point to, is just a commitment to ecumenism.
Yeah.
And just broader perspectives. The Bible and the gospel and missions is what count the most in the whole scheme of things. I love being reformed, but it's not the only thing or the main thing. The main thing is the gospel. And I can just say from my own experience as a mainline minister, I was just so committed, my father and my grandfather, so committed to that, that we were just going to stay the course and proclaim the gospel. And even though traditional reformed theology had been compromised, in some places even basic orthodoxy was beginning to be compromised, until God called us out, or we felt like the red line had been crossed, we were going to stay the course. And I think the vast majority of Presbyterians, in terms of sheer numbers, the numbers of evangelicals that stayed in the mainline churches for a long time, kind of had that spirit about things. And it's the reason seminaries like Fuller and Gordon Conwell were established.
Yeah.
Provide evangelical clergy when the mainline seminaries weren't doing the job anymore.
I like how you put that with the red line, and everyone draws one somewhere. That's really been the struggle, because there are yep. differences of thought and opinion on where you do that, whether that's with your own ecumenical body or with whom you have fraternal relations, for example, like the question of ecumenism. That's something that Ken and I have talked offline about a little bit, just on Ned Stonehouse and some of the work I have been starting up. You know, doing some work on Stonehouse's ecumenical efforts. And he didn't win the day in the OPC. I think eventually the OPC arrived at a position that he would have been happy with, but those options were not available to him at the time when he was alive. But that leads me into more of the question here of chapter 19, evangelical marginalization and resurgence, and perhaps even to some of the more specific denominational histories represented by you, Don, with the EPC now, as well as Ken, you with the PCA. So 1981, 1973, respectively, if I'm correct. You know, the OPC's separation was in 36. But the story, in many ways, at least the generalities of the stories, are similar. I grew up in the mainline church, but since I'm a young pup, relatively speaking, I was born in 1980. I grew up in what at the time was the product of a merger, the UPC USA. That church in recent years has moved and joined with the EPC. But I'm wondering if you two brothers might explain some of these trends that gave rise to the PCA, the EPC, and the ECO. What is unique, I should say, what is common? What is common among those stories, and how, and what does that tell us about American Presbyterianism in the latter part of the 20th century?
Okay. Well, I'll let Ken go first this time.
I think Don has already identified some of the factors that enabled conservative Presbyterians to survive in what were becoming increasingly hostile situations. And the key term is ecumenism, evangelical ecumenism. The significance of Gordon Conwell, of the early Fuller Seminary, also for a period of time, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, in training conservative candidates for the mainline Presbyterian ministry. This cannot be exaggerated too much. This was the workaround of finding alternative places in which future pastors would be trained, and it was very largely successful. It was successful in sustaining an evangelical theological position within the mainline denomination. But these people had their own red lines, and when those red lines were crossed, for the PCA, it was the impending merger with the Northern Presbyterian Church. For the EPC, it was the Casement case. And in the case of ECO, the red line has been LGBTQ questions. But the ability to recognize the red line when it came is a tribute to the alternative theological networks which had come into existence to sustain mainline evangelicals. And it wasn't just seminaries. There were alternative Sunday school curriculum materials available from publishers like Gospel Light, behind which stood Henrietta Mears. There were alternative youth ministry programs like Young Life and Pioneer Girls. You could operate these ministries without any dependence on the head office of a mainline denomination at all. And it's the cumulative effect of these cooperative evangelical agencies that is necessary to explain how evangelicalism sustained itself in increasingly hostile circumstances over a 50-year period. So I think evangelical ecumenism is absolutely key to explaining this.
If I may just jump in, Cameron.
Please.
I appreciate all that's being said very much, gentlemen. It's good to be a part of this discussion. One of the things I would have liked to have seen towards the end of the book is coming from the perspective of evangelical ecumenism, maybe just a bit more of it wouldn't have to be too long, but I'll call it a postmortem on the mainline church, because, you know, you have the 58 influx of the UPC-US. So you have, of course, the 83, the joining the PCUS with the becoming again the PCUSA. But the high watermark, I should have re-looked at all of this. I think it's 65. You got 4.25 million in the PCUSA. And then I believe the stated clerk of the GA of the PCUSA reported, the last official reporting was the end of 21, 1.19 million. Mm. And just, I would have liked to have seen something from your perspective, analyzing that. 4.25 million, 1965. 1.19 million at the end of 2021.
Maybe
that's a pretty remarkable story.
The deluxe edition.
I'd really like to hear your takes on that. I mean, you've said a lot of things that are all part of it, but I mean, is there a takeaway of, you know, not being evangelical and or confessional in some fashion, and the price that's to be paid for that? What's happened with the PCUSA?
Well, you know, that's a good point. And candidly, I think part of the issue, at least from my perspective on that whole question, because I think that's a very valid critique, Alan, on that, is given the fact that we were trying to make the book is broadly accessible to the entire Presbyterian family. I know for me, I was hesitant to absolutely bring the hammer down at the end in the way that in my gut I wanted to. Mm. But the reality is the statistics speak for themselves. I mean, if you look at one of the reasons we wanted to put the chart in the back of the book, with the numbers, the estimates that we were given that we could find on the different churches, just it's very clear that the mainline church is dying. And the reality is that the host of evangelical Presbyterian bodies, we have become more and more mainline Presbyterianism. I mean, we are Presbyterianism in America. We are continuing to grow, some of us faster than others. The mainline is continuing to decrease. It has been for decades. And so I think the reality is, as I anticipate in the 21st century, that the numbers of the evangelical bodies are going, if you add them all up, are going to surpass the mainline denomination. And I prefer to use the term old line rather than mainline anymore. Because I think they really don't represent vibrant Presbyterianism in America anymore.
Can I steal that from you, Don?
Sure, go ahead.
The thing I'd like to contribute to this, and I appreciate Alan's question, is that you should not neglect the conclusion of the book, because the conclusion carries with it some cautions and some warnings. I'm not taking away from what Don has said. Statistically, it's conservative Presbyterian bodies that are growing. But there are telltale signs that the same trends which have undermined the health of the mainline are undermining the health of other churches too, such as declining biblical literacy, the absence of doctrinal preaching, the failure to pay more than lip service to confessional standards. These are the things that led to the ill health of the mainline. And these are things which, if they are not attended to, will undermine the current hopeful situation of the more conservative denominations. But we're in a culture war, and the culture war has already wreaked its damage on the mainline. What damage will it do to the other churches? And there is real reason for concern that our integrity is being undermined, though more gradually. So that's a soft way of delivering the message. But I agree with what Don said. We had to rely on understatement, given the audience that we were trying to reach. But we didn't leave the future completely unaddressed. We did raise those questions.
Yeah. That's really thoughtful.
That's what I figured you would say. I kind of wanted to give you I appreciate both of your answers enormously. And I think it's just helpful for everybody who reads this. Again, I'm not surprised by what you're saying in the least. I suspected that it was sub rosa. and I realize what you're doing ecumenically. And sometimes you have to say things sub rosa. I mean, we have different ecumenical spheres, and I've been since 1998. I mean, and I'm currently the president of the board of GCP, which is not that terribly ecumenical. It's OP and PCA, but still, even there, we have to learn to live together, right? And do so well and helpfully. And we love, we serve EPC. We're really, we're serving a lot, and we're trying to serve more. And we want to be properly explicit, but not improperly explicit. We don't want to give unnecessary offense. And so, yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate what you're saying.
That's thoughtful. Well, brothers, I really appreciate you taking the time today. This has been a fascinating conversation. I'd love to perhaps do a round two or three where we can dive down perhaps into a specific chapter or two and really start to get into some of the specifics. But this has been fascinating. Thanks so much for joining us, all three of you, but particularly our guests, our authors today. Thanks so much, Ken and Don. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
You bet. Anytime. We'd love to revisit. Of course, the book here is Reformed and Evangelical Across Four Centuries, The Presbyterian Story in America. It's published by Erdmann's Publishing. It's available all over the place. We'll have links to that in their episode description. And of course, along with our guests today, Kenneth Stewart and Don Fortson, co-authored by Nathan Feldmuth and Garth Rosell, with a foreword by George Marsden. We really encourage you to pick this up, to read it, and you'll find, absolutely, you'll find things that are interesting. But more than that, you'll find stories and historical narratives that will benefit you. You'll find information through all the links that I'll have in the episode description. But of course, a reminder to visit us online at reformedforum.org, where you'll find information about all of our programs, our online video courses available for free, as well as upcoming events and other episodes. But I do want to take the time to thank you all for listening and for watching. And we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.